It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about what's at stake for food assistance programs in a bill in the U.S. House today.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Langdon Cook about the underground world of mushroom hunting, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And before we get to these calls, we've got a lot of them. I want to ask you, you know, how much did Doug make at this mushroom hunt when you were out with him? Is it a decent living?
You know, it's a tough way to make a living. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, there are some pickers who do a little better than others, but you really have to be on it all the time, ready to move when the weather shifts, keeping your sort of ear to the ground as far as where the mushrooms are fruiting. You have to be willing to pull stakes and head somewhere else. So, I mean, it is a tough way to make a living. You know, I talked to a picker who said that he picked an incredible morel flush one year. And we have this phenomenon. I know you love your morels in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
We have this phenomenon in the West where after the mountain wildfires, there can be really huge morel flushes the following spring. Mm. And so the pickers follow they're fire watchers. They keep tabs on where all the forest fires are, and then they start scouting them in the early spring and you know, hope for that big morel flush. And I talked to this one picker named Bill who said, you know, he was making about $1,000 a day picking a really great morel flush in Idaho.
Wow.
And he was doing that for days, I mean, for weeks, really. And that funded pretty much his entire year. I think he went down to Costa Rica after that.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Okay. If you get lucky, you can hit it pretty big. If you get lucky.
That's right. And you got to be at the right place at the right time. And you have to be able to sort of unravel the puzzle of mushrooms. That's the thing. They're conundrums. They're tricky. You got to understand all sorts of factors that go into their fruiting, from, you know, tree canopy to soil type to weather conditions. All these things work in concert to produce flushes of mushrooms, and you have to understand all the moving parts.
Let's get to the phones now. We have Kathy joining us on Madeline Island. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Excuse me. One of my favorite subjects on the planet, mushrooms. I've been picking them for about 40 years, and never trying to make a living out of it. Have sold them on occasion when I've you know, caught a huge bloom of maybe chanterelles. The morel or the boletes this year were fabulous. But the question I have is, I encounter an awful lot of mushroom phobia from folks. They're just petrified that I'm going to have picked a poisonous mushroom. And I have to listen to that story of the mycologist, I think he was in Minnesota, who killed himself with a mushroom he picked. I can't tell you how many times I've had to hear that story. So my question is, when do these pickers cross the line where they are completely accepted for the product they're delivering?
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Thank you for sharing your experience. Sounds so interesting. What do you think, Langdon?
Well, I think what she's asking is, what sort of regulations are there to sort of ensure that everybody is and safe and happy with their product? I mean, it's true that this is sort of a new industry. I mean, it really didn't exist much more than 30 years ago. So it's new. The regulators are playing catch-up ball. It is a sort of a freewheeling form of capitalism out there in the woods. I refer to it as one of the last vestiges of the Wild West. And so, you know, you might be surprised to hear that there hasn't been a documented case of somebody buying wild mushrooms from, say, a farmer's market or a store that were actually not what they were supposed to be and were poisonous and killed them or made them very sick. It just hasn't happened. You know, most of the really choice edibles are pretty easy to identify. So chanterelles, porcini, black trumpets, hedgehogs, etc. They're relatively easy to identify. And so far, everyone's done a pretty good job, you know, to ensure safety. But I can see, you know, where the caller is going with that. And it does seem at times like there isn't that much apparatus. I mean, you can just kind of browse mushrooms at the farmer's market and look through the baskets and you wonder, you know, who picked these? Where did they come from? How do I know that they're safe? And I guess you're sort of you're trusting the vendor to a large degree in that case.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your call, Kathy. And let's move on to Jonathan in Madison. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right, how are you?
Doing great. I just wanted to call and say I've actually gotten into morel hunting the past few years. My friends got me into it, and it's I couldn't have said it better myself when you mentioned it, bringing you back into being like a kid again. I just have so much fun, and it's in regards to what your previous caller mentioned. Sometimes there is a misconception. There are morels that that they look like morels, but they're actually more shaped like a bell mushroom. And those I heard are somewhat poisonous. But I've come across a couple of them this last year. I guess in the Madison area was rather scarce. I know the farmers market they were charging upwards of $40-$45 a pound for morels this year.
They were expensive this year. I bought some myself since I managed to miss the season last year. But I'm curious, Jonathan, as a fellow morel fan, what's your favorite way to cook them?
Oh, my favorite way is a lot of people like to like fry them and like lightly bread them and stuff like that. I've tried that, but I you can't get much better than just keeping it simple. If I just put a little bit of butter in the pan, if you prefer, sometimes I'll put some onions in there as well, but don't really eat the onions. Just put them in there for the taste factor. But me, I just straight simple butter and morels, and it depends on how. Sometimes some people like them a little more crispy, but just keep them on a low heat. And let them get to the point where you prefer them, and then eat away.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Langdon, do you have a favorite mushroom?
Well, I was just going to agree there. I think keeping it simple is good because mushrooms have so much to offer. They have so much flavor. And the wild mushrooms, I mean, you start trying these different varieties, and you might think, these aren't really even mushrooms at all. They don't taste what my concept of a sort of a supermarket button is. I mean, they have so many different flavors. They're incredibly meaty. But my favorite, boy, you know, we're having a pretty good pop right now of King Bleats in the Cascade Mountains. And I went out picking yesterday and picked a bucket. And we cooked some of those up as soon as I got home. And, you know, just thinly sliced, sautéed in butter, little sprinkling of salt, maybe just a little herb from the garden thrown on top there. And you know what I like to do is I take a baguette and I slice it thinly and put a little ricotta cheese on each slice and then top that with the porcini that's been sautéed in the butter and then just the sprinkling of salt. And that's it. I mean, the mushroom is what's taking care of that. Porcini, by the way, has just a really wonderful kind of toasty, nutty flavor. And then when you dry it in a dehydrator, it becomes like a totally different mushroom. At that point, it is earthy. And, you know, when you inhale the aroma of it, it just seems like you're inhaling the aroma of the woods. And I use that. I grind up the dried porcini and I add it to soups and stews and sauces. And it really gives a kind of a big base note to those sort of foods.
Oh, you described that beautifully and you made everyone in the studio so hungry. Sounds divine. Can you ship us some? No, I guess you can't.
Well, dried, certainly.
Wow, that sounds pretty great. You know, I can't think of a better place to leave it than that. Everyone's mouth is watering. Langdon, thank you so much for being here with us today.
And thank you.
That was Langdon Cook, the author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America.
Coming up next, we'll discuss the food stamp bill being voted on today in the U.S. House.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Federal funding for food stamps is being debated today with a new bill on the floor of the U.S. House that proposes $40 billion in cuts to food stamps over the next decade.
The bill is broadly opposed by House Democrats, who are all expected to vote against it.
Food stamps are usually included in the U.S. Farm Bill, but they were taken out of that bill earlier this summer because conservatives argued the $20 billion in proposed cuts didn't go far enough.
And here with us now to talk about what's at stake for food assistance programs is Daniel Stein, the president of Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the House is voting on the new food stamp bill today. What does it include?
It includes $40 billion worth of cuts to people that are on the food stamp benefits. And to an organization like ours, that would mean a significant change in the amount that people need assistance. Food stamps, over 10 years, a $40 billion cut would be the equivalent of losing over 3 billion meals. And right now, the entire Feeding America food bank network only provided 3 billion meals last year. So they're looking for us to double what we are able to do next year.
And what would that mean for operations if you had to double it, if it passes?
Our building is already maxed out and full, so we'd have to figure out how to get more food in and more food out. And what we're looking for is supply, not more demand.
Well, as it is, does the SNAP or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, does that provide enough food for people to stay out of hunger for a month, say?
Actually, 90% of all people that receive that benefit run out of that benefit in the third week of the month. So, no, it doesn't.
And on average, how much would you say it provides for a family daily?
Family of four in the state of Wisconsin receives about $241 per month.
$241. So, I don't know. How do you feel about that being? I mean, I guess if you were in the house and you had someone's ear today and you had that $241 figure, what would you tell them about how far that went for a family?
Well, $241 for a family of four, if you divide it by 30 days, that's $8 per day for four people. And there's been many organizations and people that have tried to go on a challenge to see if they can live on that, including our existing congressman. And they found it a huge struggle for that to happen.
And what would you want to say to people about the significance of doubling this right now and decoupling it in a way from the farm bill the way it's been done historically? Do you think things are going to change?
I don't think they're going to change. There's a tremendous desire to balance the budget, and we agree that balancing the budget and being fiscally responsible is very important, but we're just asking that they don't do it on the backs of people who struggle with hunger.
Well, who does it affect? Can you tell us a little bit about that? You see, I imagine, even you're the CEO of Second Harvest, but you must see the people that you're helping. Tell us about some of the faces of these people and their stories and who it actually affects on a day-to-day basis.
Well, first of all, nationally, it would estimate it to affect 4 to 6 million people who would lose benefits altogether. This coming November 1st, there's going to be a cut in benefits that's been in place for some time, so that's going to affect everybody. But 4 to 6 million people would lose benefits. And the majority of people, almost three quarters of them, are either receiving this are either seniors, children, or disabled people. So those are the people that are most vulnerable, and that's the people we see that this will affect.
Now, we have been in the midst of a rocky economy for some time now, and I imagine that there has been more reliance on food banks like yours. Tell us about the change you've seen, if any, over the last several years.
In the last several years, the demand for what we do has increased by 83%. And to meet that demand, we've had to find additional sources of food and additional ways to get that food out. So we've been able to keep up with demand. But if this goes into effect, in essence, we will have to do twice as much if we're able to do it at all in order to meet what the cuts will entail.
93%, that's a big number. And I wonder if the people you're talking about, do they tend to come to you, rely on you for a while, get on their feet, and you know, not need assistance anymore? Is it a cyclical thing? Or are you seeing people who just come and they stay?
Well, unfortunately, more than half the people we serve have someone in their household that has a job. So it isn't just those that are down and out and chronically unemployed. But most of the recovery in this economy have been with jobs that are much poorer paying than they were with the job that they lost. So even if they are employed, oftentimes they may not need help for 30 days, but they may need help for several days. Food stamps and the food share benefit here in the state of Wisconsin helps these people get over that hump. It provides another means of access besides having to go to a food pantry or a soup kitchen to get some food.
And can you tell me, did the economic downturn affect donations to food banks as well?
Well, I think if you polled nonprofits, you'd probably get a variety of answers for that. We've been very blessed that people have focused on basic needs. So food, clothing, and shelter have done okay. And we're very fortunate that we've got some very loyal supporters that know the importance of a basic need like food.
How big of a role do you think charities and food banks like yours play in keeping Americans out of hunger? You're describing a time of food insecurity for a lot of people.
Well, actually, the food share, SNAP, food food stamp benefits really help keep people out of hunger a lot more than the food banks. Food banks provide assistance for several days, and it might meet the entire needs that they may have, but at the same time, they have to continually come back to food pantries and soup kitchens for other sources.
Well, what kind of changes would you like to have made to food stamps? Do you support any sort of cut, or do you think that it's just not anything that that America can afford to do right now?
I think people are surprised to learn that it isn't just an expense. The USDA has proven that for every dollar redeemed of food share benefit, SNAP benefit, $1.80 comes back to the economy and economic benefits. So it spurs activity. Instead of people going to a food pantry to get their sources of food, if they can go redeem those in a grocery store, the grocer gets business, and all the ancillary people that support that grocer also do better. So it actually brings economic benefit to the community.
Well, what kinds of food do people get from these programs? I mean, there's a big move toward localism right now, fresh food. Is it that kind of thing, or is it more non-perishables?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. We encourage people to always eat nutritiously. And one of the things that's nice about the food stamp is that they can go to whatever grocer whenever it's most convenient for them with dignity. They stand in line with a debit card just like you and I buy our groceries. We encourage them not to use those benefits on potato chips and other things, but for the most part, it provides a list of all kinds of things that they have the ability to buy with it.
How is Wisconsin doing right now in terms of need and supply?
If you're talking about food stamps, 750,000 residents of Wisconsin rely on food stamps. And of that total, nearly a third of those are children. That's a huge concern for us. Children, it's been proven, don't perform as well in school. If they're hungry and they can't concentrate and can't focus and don't do well on tests, they end up dropping out. And kids, especially young kids that grew up in poverty when they're in their adolescence, are much more likely not to complete high school. So it has ramifications with school, but also if they eat properly and don't go without meals, then their health is more robust, and that's also very important.
What do you say to people who are saying that the priority needs to be on the budget right now, that America is in a sticky spot and tough choices need to be made, and maybe we need to figure out some other measure to care for people and to get them the food they need, but maybe this is necessary now?
I guess what we say is that we totally understand the importance of balancing the budget and getting our fiscal house in order, but we're asking that they don't do it on the backs of the most vulnerable, those that struggle with hunger.
Are food stamps, do you think, an effective way in your experience to meet hunger needs, or would there be something more effective should we need it? You know, necessity is the mother of invention.
All I can speak for is that food stamps are very effective.
And you mentioned many people receiving food aid. They have jobs, and yet they're still coming to you. They still need help. How many people would you say are in that situation? People who are employed, but who still need help and to lean on the food banks?
I think our most recent study in the 16 counties that my food bank serves, 54% of them received or had a job that were looking towards us for assistance. And to put that number in perspective is over those 16 counties last year, we served an estimated 141,000 different people in southern Wisconsin.
What do you think? Is this bill going to pass? How are you feeling today?
I don't know if it's going to pass. I do think that there's going to be some cuts to this program. The Senate version included cuts of $4.5 billion. The House version is $40 billion. I think there'll be something in between. It's unfortunate because so many people will be affected by it, but we hope that it's a smaller number.
And as far as the Farm Bill, and it used to be food stamps were part of the Farm Bill, now that this has happened, do you expect this to be the new normal?
Well, for decades, the Farm Bill included the food stamp piece and farm subsidies, et cetera. It was always passed bipartisan. It was never really a question until last year. And last year, they couldn't come to an agreement, so they delayed it for a year. This year, they're struggling, and that's why it was broken in half, figuring they could at least get part of it done and work on the other part. And that's the part that they're working on right now.
Now, I imagine you talk to a lot of people who agree with you because they use the food bank. But how do you feel about the pulse of popular sentiment right now? Is it on your side? Does it want to say no to these cuts?
I think people are truly concerned about those people who struggle. And Whether there's a better way of doing it or not, that'll be determined. But the important thing is, again, please don't cut for the people that struggle with hunger and keep this in place.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Daniel Stein, president of Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin.
Coming up, a look at our brains. Our guest says some of the things we believe about the way our brains work are more folklore than fact. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. If you're a creative person, you must be right-brained, right? Wrong, according to a growing body of scientific research.
But why is that? Our next guest explains why the right-brain, left-brain arguments, first of all, caught on in the public, and how scientific myths like this tend to stick.
Maggie Ryan Sanford joins us. She's a science writer devoted to promoting scientific literacy. She wrote an article called Art and the Right Brain Fallacy, and she joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio to talk about it. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So tell us about the origins of this right brain creative, left brain logical idea that we have and how it got started.
Right. So this all started back in the 90s with a study that Dr. Gazzagna did. He is a psychologist and biopsychologist, to be fair. He was working with a patient named Joe who had had his corpus callosum severed, so because he was an epileptic, severe epileptic, and this procedure helps calm seizures because it kind of disrupts the electric storms, they call them, that happen between the two hemispheres. So Dr. Gazzagna took this opportunity to kind of see what was going on with the two hemispheres of his brain, what would happen if they weren't communicating with each other, and found that there were some functions that didn't translate from one hemisphere to the other. And then kind of rounded up and said, well, you know, we know that the right hemisphere kind of recognizes the whole picture, like sees a face in a group of objects, whereas the left hemisphere will find specifics, knows the words for things, and kind of pulls details out of chaos. And then kind of, like I said, rounded up and decided that this meant that the right and left hemispheres overall had strengths and weaknesses, which immediately the popular culture kind of latched onto because in my theory, people like to know about themselves. They kind of like to hear, hey, you know, I'm more of a kind of calculating, unemotional, mathematical mind. And so I must have a stronger left hemisphere. This was perpetuated by self-help books and kind of know yourself, get to use your strengths kind of culture that happened afterward. And it's kind of stuck around.
Well, we want to dig a little more into how that spread and how it caught on. But first of all, what's some of the research that's been done since then? I mean, is it really not true that we have this stark division of labor between the sides of our brains?
Definitely we don't have a stark division of labor because if we did, we probably wouldn't get that much done. More and more research is showing that almost every function, you know, when you think about a function that you're doing in your everyday life, it's a little bit different than what we mean when we say, when we refer to a brain function. A brain function can be something very specific, one specific neural communication at a synapse level. And when you're thinking about functions that you do in your everyday life, you're thinking about, you know, going to the store and everything that's required in that, getting in your car and driving and deciding what you need and all of those processes. In order to carry out any real world action, you need to have all of these neural pathways firing. And the recent study that kind of came out and brought this conversation about the left brain, right brain fallacy, some people are calling it, back into the scientific conversation, basically asked that specific question, looked at 1,011 different individuals from ages 7 to 29, and compared their brain activity at the very micro level, looking at they divided the brain into 7,000 regions and looked at the connections between those regions, because more and more we're realizing that anytime you want to get some answers out of what the brain is doing, it's more about the connectivity than it is about the pinpointed neurons, basically. And found that when there were more connections in one hemisphere of the brain, it was more about where those connections originated. So basically, if a person, one of the subjects that they were looking at the brain scan, if they had more going on in one hemisphere of the brain, it was probably because of a particular thought process that was happening at that moment, not about what was happening in their brain overall.
I have to admit, this is interesting to hear, because this is something that, you know, I've heard and sort of it took to be truth for a long time. And in fact, there's a book called The Master and the Emissary by Ian McGilchrist from not too long ago. It was incredibly popular and influential. I know, you know, some artists locally who are reading it and trying to connect with their right brain. And this is from just a year or two ago, and he's a pretty influential guy. And as I understand it, his work is getting a lot of attention in circles that study consciousness. So is there still some controversy about this?
Absolutely. I mean, nobody likes to hear that the myth or the information that they've perpetuated in their work isn't true by other people. But that's true in every area of science. There are going to be different schools of thought and skeptics no matter what. But the best way that I can think to describe it is that the study that Dr. Gazzagna did was a psychological study. It wasn't a neurological study. The newer study that we have at the University of Ohio is that was a neurological study looking at actual brain scans. Dr. Gazzagna was looking at behavior, and the two things are very different. In terms of the right brain, left brain idea applied to your own life and kind of labeling yourself as one or the other, I think that's still really useful. And even some of the people working on the study said as much. They said, you know, it's still possible if you look at the literature, they're saying, you know, use that idea of the left brain, right brain in terms of deciding what your strengths and weaknesses are. Absolutely. Just don't think of it as your brain is firing more on one side or the other. Partially because I think that limits your idea of what you're capable of. If you think of yourself as somebody who is more emotional, more creative, you tend in on a neurological level, if that were the case, then you might give up on kind of trying to become more mathematical and analytical on that level. And I think that's what you're saying about the master and the emissary, is anybody can learn to exercise the parts of their brain that aren't necessarily what they're born with. You know, you can undertake activities that reinforce neural connections that then change your mental strength, so to speak.
Part of what we want to talk about is how this idea caught on and other scientific ideas like that. And I think what's appealing to me is it takes this incredibly complicated thing, the brain, and gives it a nice, easy metaphor that we can work with. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's part of the appeal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the brain, as you're hearing in this conversation, is so incredibly complicated. And I often think about it in the same terms as studying the universe and the laws of physics in the universe, where we're not able to look at them. You know, the brain is right there in our heads all the time, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're able to see what's going on, first of all, and then understand what we're seeing, even when we are able to use something like an fMRI to see where blood is flowing and which parts of the brain are activated. It doesn't necessarily give us all the answers that we want to. And everybody likes to think that they can understand themselves. I think it's a natural human inclination to want to identify what's going on with yourself. It gives you a sense of power. It gives you a sense of self, basically. And I think that's exactly why this particular idea has been so prevalent.
One of the things you try to do as a science writer is to promote scientific literacy. And I wonder how people feel, what kind of response you get about this research and what the researchers themselves have gotten. Do you feel at all like you're trying to bust up a party where everyone's having a good time and then you have to come in and say, no, guys, it's a lot harder than that?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm not of that school of thought. Some people certainly are. There are some members of the scientific communication community and members of the scientific community that take a little bit of delight when they get to come in and say, no, actually, you're all wrong and you've all been hyped up and you drank the Kool-Aid. But no, I'm more after what can work. You know, the reason that this idea of the right brain, left brain dichotomy perpetuated is because we didn't really have the whole story. And I think rather than coming in and being like, no, you're wrong, you know, you're looking at it in a way that's unscientific, why not say we can participate in this scientific conversation as lay people, as people who aren't necessarily neurologists or psychologists. Let's get all of the information and then decide. And that can be a lot of fun. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
So one question I wanted to get to, and we'll take a break in a moment and invite some callers. It seems like there's a fundamental challenge in science writing. People, we're storytelling creatures. We like to learn things in terms of stories, on the one hand. Mm-hmm. Science doesn't always break down into a story or a narrative. Sometimes it's a big cluster of data that we have to try to interpret. How hard is it to bridge that gap?
It can be pretty hard. Sometimes you have these great narratives that emerge from scientific research. I'm trying to think of some off the top of my head. You know, the story about the apple falling out of the tree and hitting Sir Isaac Newton on the head, that didn't actually happen, but he does have a really interesting life story that you can call upon when you're talking about the way that he found what he found, the way that he was doing his research, and how it related to his everyday life. Sometimes that's not the case. And yet, science is still carried out by human beings. You know, scientists are human beings that have lives and life stories, and whether they would like it or not, emotions and interests and histories. And I think for me, I'm interested in looking at those histories, getting to know scientists as human beings and seeing how that influences their work. The challenge there is how do you respect their scientific authority. And, every scientist wants to seem as unbiased as possible. And once you start getting into the personal stuff, that becomes more difficult. So I think that the challenge that I have is getting to know scientists, letting them talk freely as human beings, and still understanding that the science that they're doing is as scientific as possible to the best of their ability.
We're talking right now with science writer Maggie Ryan Sanford about the myth that certain things like our creativity or our ability to analyze are controlled by only one side of the brain at a time, the left or the right.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. A couple questions for you. Even if the left brain, right brain thing isn't true, do you think it's useful? Do you think it helps you in your life? Do you have a place you go to for great science reporting? What makes good science reporting and good myth busting like this? 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And you can also post on our Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR. We'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with Maggie right after this. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about scientific fallacies right now. The idea maybe that people are left-brained or right-brained. Why certain myths initially based on science catch on easily while others might not.
And what do you think that is? What more could scientists and science journalists do to make science easier to understand? Are you attached to the left brain, right brain idea that's been around for so long? Is it going to be hard to let go of? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or share your ideas on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest is Maggie Ryan Sanford, science writer. We'll go to the phones now. We have Amy with us in Waukesha. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us?
I have a almost 12-year-old daughter who excels in reading, has had some challenges with math, has always been a little bit on the klutzy side, and recently, within the last year, we did a visual test that led to an MRI, an emergency MRI, and learned that she's missing approximately 25% of the tissue in her left brain due to some cysts that have been there apparently since birth, and we had no idea. And so there are some things that her right brain wasn't able to accommodate for, such as vision on the right side of both of her eyes. So amazingly, she accommodated for that as well, because nobody has ever noticed that she wasn't seeing, and she couldn't tell us that she wasn't seeing, because this is what she's seen for her whole life. But in all other regards, she has excelled academically. She really just didn't know, and so it's really amazing to us that she could, that her right brain and what was left of her left brain could accommodate to this degree.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Maggie, I guess one of the lessons here, and a lot of the research you're talking about, the brain is flexible if it can accommodate for that kind of gap.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is so fascinating and so cool about the brain is we used to think that you had a certain amount of brain tissue, a certain amount of brain cells, and they were finite. You know, they didn't regenerate. And if you lost them, then you're kind of out of luck. But more recently, we've learned that that's not the case. The brain, like the other cells in the body, can regenerate. And I'm so happy to hear about Amy's daughter. It's, you know, just a testament to, I think, the fact that if you kind of take it for granted that you can learn certain things, you're going to learn them regardless of, you know, what your limitations are. And that sounds kind of like happy-go-lucky and rah, 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 the world is perfect. I'm sure that she's had some troubles, as we've heard. But I would be curious, in fact, to learn if the correlation between her reading and math strengths had much to do with the left brain problem. It's possible that she would be a more literary person anyway.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And let's move on to Julie joining us from Madison. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What
do you
think?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
I recently it's been circulating on Facebook, is this spinning lady. And she goes one direction, actually clockwise, if you are right-brained, and counterclockwise if you are left-brained. And everybody I know who is extremely, considers themselves creative and right-brained, she goes clockwise. And the people that are stereotypically, that I know left-brained, she goes counterclockwise. A couple people I know she can switch back and forth, but it seems very predictive.
Interesting. And Maggie, what do you think when you hear that? Obviously,
right.
It's
that
appealing.
Exactly. It is appealing. I can't speak to the spinning lady in particular. I haven't seen it. And also, I'm not a neurologist, so I can't for sure speak to that phenomenon. I am reminded, though, of a study that Dr. Gazzagna himself did, where you, I think, have heard about the idea that left-handed people are more right-brained. They tend to be more right-brained. If indeed we were going back to this idea of left or right brain dominance. So Dr. Gazzagna himself was interested in perpetuating that idea. The word dominance is really kind of the arguable word there. But even in his own research, he did some studies on left-handed people and found that 40% of the time they were right brain dominant, according to his metrics, and 40% of the time they were left brain dominant, and the other 20% of the time they could do both, kind of like you're describing with the spinning lady. So I don't know how that necessarily correlates with the identity that people are pulling from the idea if they're right brain or left brained. Not being a neurologist, I would guess that there is probably some power of suggestion there, perhaps, that if you identify as one, then you're going to expect one result. But I certainly can't speak to the spinning lady on any scientific level.
thanks for the call, Julie.
And, well, thanks, Julie. You know, it's interesting, too, that, you know, this is a cool theory. You can see why it caught on. You know, Rob was talking about the simplicity. It's sort of elegant in the way it helps you understand things. On the other hand, we had the caller was talking about the way her daughter's brain had compensated for missing tissue. And what's really seems to be emerging a lot is sort of the plasticity of the brain and the fact that the brain can compensate and create workarounds and can come back from a stroke and things like that. And in a way, you know, if you're going to have a brain, which we do, wouldn't you rather have a brain that's more flexible and plastic and can solve problems, you know, from both hemispheres than just having this sort of dogmatic left brain, right brain thing?
Right, exactly. And I actually wanted to say to Amy that she should feel encouraged, feel free to encourage her daughter to continue working on that math part. Just because she's struggling with it right now doesn't mean that has to stay that way. And she knows that better than most people. I have a friend who always considered herself a right-brained person. And as she went through her life, she had some medical trouble and finally decided that she wanted to become a doctor, despite the fact that her entire life, all of this left brain, right brain evidence had told her that that wasn't going to be her forte. And lo and behold, she's studying really hard. It's probably a little more difficult for her being creatively inclined as opposed to analytically inclined. But she's doing it. And as she goes along, she's noticing that it gets easier for her. And I think that you can see a little bit of that brain plasticity in practice.
Maggie, earlier you mentioned some of the amazing imaging we can do of brains now and see what lights up when. But it seems like there's almost a cottage industry of people explaining human behavior because this part of the brain lights up when you see a green cereal box, but that brain lights up when you eat shrimp. Do you think people are reading too much into these scans, or is there really promise there?
You made up the shrimp study,
I
Rob.
Did. I've
never heard of it.
Is that it? Is that a Repo Man reference? Plate of shrimp.
Oh, maybe. Accidentally. Wait, let's see where my brain is lighting up when I say that, if it's in the Repo
right,
Man
exactly.
zone.
Right, exactly. The Repo Man region is lighting up. What was the question? Right, the cottage industry. I think any time that a new technology comes out and seems to have a bunch of answers that we didn't have before, it's very exciting. And people necessarily want to cash in on that. I think that, first of all, just say that plenty of the neuroimaging that's happening out there is done by scientists who know what they're doing and will collect the results and analyze them appropriately. But I think when you get excited about a technology like that, it can make you forget about all of the other resources that you have at your disposal. And for instance, I was speaking to Dr. Lori Marino, who is a dolphin researcher specializing in the brain. And she's one of the pioneers of trying to neuroimage dolphins and has learned a lot. You know, a lot of the research that she has become famous for has to do with that. And yet where she's thinking that she wants to go in the future, kind of to get more answers about cognition, is looking at the evolution of the brain and going out into the field and watching the behaviors that are actually happening, for the very reason that just because blood flows to a certain area of the brain, it doesn't tell you everything that you want to know.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Maggie. I'm sorry, we're out of time. I'd appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, too.
That was Maggie Ryan Sanford, a science writer devoted to promoting scientific literacy.
Coming up in the wake of Monday's mass shooting at the Washington Naval Yard, we'll talk with a psychologist about how we react to such events and what motivates the people who perpetrate them. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.